From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The fourth leading cause of death in the United States now is infection incurred during a hospital stay, according to an investigative series in the Chicago Tribune. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with journalist Michael Behrens, who wrote the series. He says the problem is largely preventable and is exacerbated by hospital cutbacks and the carelessness of some doctors and nurses. Also, we talk with two veteran nurses about how the nursing shortage and staff cutbacks are affecting their jobs and hospital healthcare in general. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Prague, the debut novel by Arthur Phillips. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush staged a White House ceremony today to dramatize his signing of a law that toughens penalties for corporate fraud and increases oversight of the accounting industry. The president said the law would mean hard time in prison for corporate criminals rather than easy money. Mr. Bush blamed the recent wave of business scandals for the drop in investor confidence that has shaken the stock markets. The new law makes securities fraud a crime, and it increases the penalties for other business crimes such as mail fraud and wire fraud. It creates an independent private board to monitor the accounting industry. At least five people were wounded when a Palestinian suicide bomber killed himself in front of a food stand in downtown Jerusalem today. Israeli police identified the bomber as a 17-year-old Palestinian from the West Bank. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
It was the first suicide bombing in Jerusalem since a pair of bombings claimed 26 lives more than a month ago, and police said this attack could have been much worse. Jerusalem police spokesman Kobi Zrihan says police believe the bomber was looking for a more crowded location, but set off his device after being spotted by a policeman.
We suppose that it was exploded, but the fact that he saw a police officer prevented him in getting to other place.
In the West Bank, two Jewish settlers were shot and killed by Palestinian gunmen. The shooting occurred in a Palestinian village under Israeli security control. The army said it was searching for the killers. In the settlement of Itamar, a Palestinian stabbed a settler who was not fatally injured. The attacker was killed. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Jerusalem.
The chairman of the Federal Communications Commission assured Congress today that the financial turmoil in the telecommunications industry will not lead to disruptions in telephone or internet service. Lawmakers also heard testimony from the leaders of three troubled telecom firms. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports.
WorldCom CEO John Sidgemore apologized for the accounting scandal at his firm that has rocked an already shaky telecom industry. He also made a promise.
WorldCom will continue to deliver world-class service to all of its customers, residential customers, business customers, and the government, without disruption.
Executives of Quest Communications and Global Crossing also pledged to turn their firms around. Global Crossing entered bankruptcy in January, and Quest announced earlier this week its plans to restate earnings after discovering $1 billion in misreported revenues. FCC Chairman Michael Powell told lawmakers increased fines for illegal activities would give his agency tougher enforcement power. Allison Aubrey, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 31 points to close at 8,680 in very heavy trading of about 1.8 billion shares. The Nasdaq Composite Index gained 9 points. It closed at 1,344. The S&P 500 gained 2 points to close at 902. This is NPR News. Fire officials in Oregon are worried that two massive wildfires may combine in the Siskiyou National Forest, threatening nearby towns. The first fire has grown to more than 70,000 acres as it moves south in the direction of a 25,000-acre fire. Officials have put about 17,000 people in an area north of the California border that they may have to evacuate. Firefighters have been visiting homes in the path of the blazes, trying to assess whether the houses have too many trees or too much brush around them to be saved. In Colorado, a new wildfire is threatening the headquarters of Mesa Verde National Park. Eric Whitney reports from Cortez, Colorado.
More than 70 buildings, including park headquarters, are threatened by the fire at this time. At least 11 aircraft and more than 100 firefighters are working to protect the structures. Mesa Verde is famous for its numerous ancient cliff dwellings and other archaeological resources. Park Superintendent Larry Weiss says he doesn't expect them to be damaged by the fire itself, but burned over areas quickly become prone to erosion that can damage artifacts. Also of concern is whether there's enough water in and around the high desert park to effectively fight the fire. Federal officials say the situation is not yet critical. Mesa Verde remains closed until further notice. Shortly after lightning started the blaze Monday afternoon, all 500 park employees and about 2,000 tourists were evacuated. So far, the fire has destroyed 3 homes inside the park. For NPR News, I'm Eric Whitney in Cortez, Colorado.
At a giant mass today in Guatemala City, Pope John Paul II canonized Central America's first saint. At least 350,000 Roman Catholics attended the mass for Pedro de San Jose Betancourt, a missionary who worked in the 17th century. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Wallace Reader's Digest Funds, seeking to enrich community life through support of education, the arts, and culture.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Patients go into hospitals hoping for treatments that will make them better, but sometimes they pick up infections in the hospital that are life-threatening. Often these infections are spread through unsanitary facilities, germ-laden instruments, and the unwashed hands of doctors and nurses. My guest Michael Behrens is an investigative reporter for the Chicago Tribune. This month he wrote a 3-part series on hospital-acquired infections. He reports that deaths linked to hospital germs represent the 4th leading cause of mortality among Americans behind heart disease, cancer, and strokes. The total was about 103,000 deaths in the year 2000, which is the latest year that federal health inspection reports are available. Behrens estimates that about 3/4 of these deaths were preventable through better hygiene and more sanitary conditions. I asked Michael Behrens to tell us more about how germs are spread in hospitals.
If you examine federal investigative reports and state reports, you'll just find thousands of cases in which doctors conducted operations without washing their hands first. You'll see thousands of cases in which nurses went bed to bed without washing their hands. One case in particular stands out of a doctor in Los Angeles who placed a stethoscope on the patient of who was in the complete grip of pneumonia. And this kind of moist, sweaty stethoscope that was placed on this patient was placed directly on the chest of another patient who contracted pneumonia. And another kind of breakdown we saw in Chicago, a tuberculosis patient was allowed to wander the hallways of the hospital. Several other patients contracted tuberculosis as a result of that contact and died.
What did you find in terms of cleanliness, of how well and how thoroughly hospital rooms are cleaned so as not to spread germs from one patient to another?
I think one of the amazing findings was how often hospitals fail to clean rooms between patient admissions. And this is a direct byproduct of house cleaning staffs being pared down at least 25% nationally. What we found in half of the Chicago hospitals, for instance, which is mirrored nationally, is that house cleaning staffs were rubbing disinfectants on bed rails, on walls, on floors, and then immediately wiping it off. However, the instructions for these disinfectants say that the solution has to sit on the surface for 5 to 10 minutes minimum. Otherwise, it's not killing any germs. But in the rush of medicine today, these house cleaning staffs who are giving dozens, maybe hundreds of rooms to clean a night are just slapping it on, wiping it off, and rushing off to the next room.
So you attribute that to staff cutting and cost cutting?
Absolutely. I think if you talk to the American Hospital Association, they will tell you that hospitals have never been in more dire financial straits. In fact, they say it's never been worse since World War II. Consequently, 1/3 of America's hospitals are bankrupt. 1/3 of America's hospitals are teetering on the edge of bankruptcy. So with that many hospitals financially challenged right now, one of the first recovery methods is to cut your staff.
Is the cleaning staff of a hospital supposed to be specially trained?
Yes, absolutely. The cleaning staff has to be specially trained on how to handle these sensitive solutions, which can be dangerous to them, not let alone the patients if they're exposed to them improperly. Also, the cleaning staffs need to be trained on how to apply these disinfectants. And time again, federal inspectors will line up these cleaning staffs in a line and say, demonstrate how you put this cleaner on. And time again, the cleaning staffs fail to put it on properly. What this means for the patient is that when they go into a room in virtually any hospital in America, they stand a risk of picking up the germs that were left behind by the last patient.
There's also a nursing shortage in the United States. In some places, the shortage is because no one's applying for the positions. In other places, it's because of cost-cutting, just like eliminating a lot of nursing positions. And I'm wondering how you think the diminished size of nursing staffs at many hospitals is contributing to the hospital-acquired infection problem.
America's nurses are the primary sentinel of our healthcare system. You subtract from that in any way, and the patients are going to suffer immediately. And I think there are just thousands and thousands of cases out there that prove this point, often with tragic consequences.
A Harvard School of Public Health study recently linked the staffing levels of registered nurses to hospital-acquired infections. They found that the lesser the number of registered nurses on staff, the more likely a patient is to acquire urinary tract infections, hospital-acquired pneumonia, and a couple of other related infections. Why are those particular infections more likely to happen if there are fewer registered nurses on the staff of a hospital?
Well, urinary tract infections, which are the most common infection in a hospital striking the largest number of people, are typically caused from contaminated instruments. And so if nurses are rushing or they're not enough nurses and their hands are dirty and they haven't had time to clean their hands between patients, sometimes the equipment that they use becomes contaminated. With pneumonia, which is a respiratory disease and one of the most popular infections from a statistical point of view, this requires constant monitoring of a patient to determine whether they're showing the signs of stress, whether they're showing elevated fevers. And in hospital after hospital, and I continue to get messages every day from nurses around the country who say, you wouldn't believe how many patients they make me care for on my shift. One nurse just the other day said, I have 20 patients on my floor, and I'm left alone with these 20 patients. If I have two patients who go into a crisis, one of them is going to die. With these kinds of numbers, nurses often are rushing from crisis to crisis, and the patients in between who don't need immediate attention but who do need attention just don't get it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Behrens, and he just wrote a three-part investigative series on hospital-acquired infections. He's part of the investigative projects team at the Chicago Tribune. Did you find an example of a hospital that has made improvements and has a decreased number of hospital-acquired infections?
We found many, many hospitals around the country which had significant, devastating, lethal outbreaks, which then came back, corrected problems, and virtually eliminated every infection in the unit or even hospital-wide. One of the most telling examples occurred in Detroit, I believe, at Grace Hospital in 1997. This was a hospital where a germ broke out in the intensive care unit of a nursery. It killed a baby, this germ called Pseudomonas, which likes to live in water, but which is typically spread by touch. The first baby died 7 days after birth. Within a week or two, the germ entered another baby, then another, then another. Four babies died very quickly within just a few weeks. The hospital then began to realize that they had an outbreak. By the time they got it under control, months later, 15 other babies had contracted the same infection. As they tried to unravel what had happened, they found the germ, after checking each of their employees, on the hands of a respiratory therapist who had been allowed to go into the intensive care unit to do medical care. But this person brought in a germ on their hands. They believe that this respiratory therapist, who I think remarkably had a colostomy at the time from an illness, carried those germs from his or her own illness right into that nursery. Certainly the infection rate in that nursery skyrocketed, but the hospital, which has since been renamed under new management, Sinai Grace, has come in and instituted stricter infection control policies and have virtually eradicated every germ in that nursery.
What are their infection control policies, some of the ones that we're likely to understand as people who aren't, those of us who aren't doctors or nurses?
Well, the primary infection control policy, actually the one that's the simplest to implement, but unfortunately the deficiency that kills the most people, is washing hands. You would be surprised at how many people just don't wash their hands in a hospital. And the studies show that doctors are the worst offenders, not nurses. Beyond washing hands, the next probably most common infection control procedure is what they call contact isolation. If a patient has an infection, they should be isolated from other patients. I don't know how many stories I've heard and seen documented where patients with infections were allowed to leave their rooms and go down the hallway and get a drink out of the public drinking fountain where other patients might go to get a drink, or they're allowed to go down to the cafeteria. Those are the kinds of things that just colonize an entire hospital with germs.
Did you actually go to a lot of hospitals when you were writing this series?
It became kind of a joke in the newsroom, but one of my hobbies for the last year and a half, if you want to call it a hobby, was to visit every hospital I could. If I was in town on a convention, I would go to a hospital and eat my lunch there in the cafeteria. And I found the most remarkable stories by just going into hospitals and sitting in the waiting rooms, sitting in the cafeterias, and just observing how nurses interacted. We saw a case in Florida where nurses took their lunches outside and sat on a picnic table to eat their lunch, and these dozens of birds, including ducks, would congregate at their feet looking for crumbs that fell from the picnic table. But as the birds are running around, they're brushing up against the nurses' legs, they're brushing up against their lab coats, and then we'd watch these nurses, who now have contaminated clothes, walk right back into the emergency room or the operating room areas. One of the other stories, or one of the other cases that I saw just from sitting in a waiting room, was a nurse who brought a giant bag of cheese puffs to the nursing station. This was one of those king-size bags, and she opens it up, and it's now become kind of a communal bag for the rest of the nurses and the medical staff. And over the course of an hour, we watched as 21 people put their hands into this bag. Then we started following the nurses, and we watched them as they treated patients, doing blood pressure, taking temperatures, changing bandages. And then they would come right out of the patient's room, put their hand back into that bag, grab some cheese puffs, then go off to another patient room.
Without washing their hands?
Without washing their hands.
So did that make it in the series?
No, we didn't use the cheese puff example just because I had seen that about 2 years ago when I was working on the nursing series. So I've been accumulating these anecdotes for years. And also, it helped assure me that the things I was seeing on paper in these federal investigative reports, I could see for myself.
My guest Michael Behrens wrote a 3-part investigative series for the Chicago Tribune on hospital-acquired infections. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about hospital-acquired infections. My guest Michael Behrens wrote a 3-part investigative series on the subject for the Chicago Tribune. It was published earlier this month. What inspired your investigative series on hospital-acquired infections?
The hospital-acquired infection story was really an outgrowth of our nursing investigation from a couple years ago. As I was going around the country and documenting how hospital staffs were being systematically reduced to save money, I came across the fact that infections were really one of the underlying issues when it came to patient safety. So after we were done documenting nurses, we turned our attention to infections, and it was a whole new territory for us. We had never really examined infections. It's a topic that's very difficult to quantify because infection rates in this country are considered confidential. So it was truly kind of cracking this veil of secrecy and using, literally dozens of information sources and combining them for the first time, often in unique ways, that allowed us to kind of get this inner portrait of what's going on inside America's hospitals.
What are some of the information sources you relied on?
Some of the primary information was computerized databases of medical records. For instance, in the state of Illinois, every patient who enters a hospital is computerized, and that information includes their age, their sex, how many days did they spend in the hospital, every diagnosis, every procedure that was performed, how did they pay for the procedure. So you get dozens and dozens of pieces of information on every patient who goes in. So using those kinds of computer databases, for instance, we can zero in on babies born in hospitals, of course, and look at how many infants contract infections 2 days, 3 days, 4 days after birth. How many infants never leave the hospital for some reason? And you can look at those codes and those procedures and determine what happened to those infants. And you can do this as well for adults, specifically in cardiac surgery. How many patients went in for a bypass procedure and ended up having their sternum removed because it was infected?
If you were going into the hospital now or had a friend or family member who was, what's some of the things you'd keep an eye out for?
If I was going into the hospital today, I would just religiously adhere to the advice that nurses in California have told me, never be alone. And in fact, the nurses of America have formed what they call buddy networks. And this is where if a nurse goes into the hospital, she has five or six friends or comrades or fellow employees who've agreed to monitor and watch her in her room, or his room in many cases. And so nurses themselves are scared to be alone in hospitals, and they've relayed this message to me and said, if you go to a hospital, you need to have someone there watching your care every minute.
Well, that's really hard to do.
Yes, it is for most of us. So there have actually been stories around the country where there are services now where patients are bringing their own nurses with them to the hospital.
Now, your new series is on hospital-acquired infections, but in the year 2000, you did a series on an investigative series on nursing.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the conclusions that you reached is that overwhelmed and inadequately trained nurses kill and injure thousands of patients every year as hospitals sacrifice safety for an improved bottom line. Can you elaborate on that finding?
Sure. I think What the Tribune found is that nurses have become both victim and perpetrator. They're being placed into impossible positions where it's almost guaranteed that they're going to make an error, or that they're going to fail, or that they're going to be unable to provide adequate care to all the patients. So many nurses are devoted and you know, give everything they have to their job. But when you give a nurse 20 patients and expect them to provide superior care to each and every patient, it's just an impossible situation. So the nurses become harried, they become overworked, and then the mistakes begin to happen. One of the most common mistakes we found, and it's a very unfortunate mistake, involves infusion pumps. Many patients who go to hospitals are connected to infusion pumps, which regulate the amount of drugs that go into your body through an IV. Nurses are rushing. So when they program those pumps to put the medication amount into you, they often make a keypad punch error. Among nurses, it's called death by decimal. But if you're supposed to receive 5.2 grams of morphine and a nurse misses the decimal point, now you're receiving 52 grams of morphine, you're going to die.
Does that happen much?
It's happened in hundreds of cases every year.
You know, one of the things my mother always used to tell me is when you leave the hospital, you should wash your hands. She would also sometimes take off her shoes before she went home so as to not bring in germs from the hospital. Do you think that's a good idea? Do you think that's necessary?
You raise what is an amazing finding, I think, scientifically. And a recent study showed that for every patient who leaves the hospital, 16% of their family members will be colonized with the germs that that patient brought home from the hospital. That means that those family members are now carrying hospital germs, and if those family members have an open sore, a wound, or if they're medically compromised in any way, they're now a likely candidate for an infection.
What kind of response have you gotten to your series on hospital-acquired infections from doctors, nurses, and hospital administrators?
I have to say the response to the infection series has just been overwhelming. And I have to say it's just been sad. I have received so many tearful calls from patients, some calling from the hospital at the bedsides of a loved one who's dying of an infection or who's just been diagnosed with an infection, and they're asking for help. And universally, patients are asking, what can I do? What can I do? And there's just not an easy answer to that. I've received maybe 30% of the messages have come from nurses who want to describe the substandard conditions in their hospital. One nurse just called me the other day and said that the hospital is now requiring all nurses to take their own medical scrubs home and wash them and wear them from home back into the hospital. Well, what we know is that if you wear your scrubs from home into the hospital, you're carrying whatever germs are in your home probably into the hospital. And we've already seen the tragedy from these kinds of cost-cutting maneuvers.
What kind of response have you gotten to your series from hospital administrators?
The hospital administrators not named in our story love it. The hospital administrators who were named in the story are not so happy, I think, of being identified with this infection issue. Most hospitals admit that this is a major problem, and in fact, many of the issues that we've reported has been well known in the healthcare field for over a decade. But I believe hospital industry is a little uneasy with the series in the sense that they know it's going to awaken the public and more people are going to demand more answers, and there are answers that the hospitals aren't necessarily willing to give at this time.
You're still going to a lot of hospital cafeterias and observing, or are those days over?
No, I plan to continue this just because I think it's a story that will continue to follow. And by doing this personal observation, although it's anecdotal, maybe even a little quirky at times, it is very valuable because you get a sense of a hospital. You get a sense of its ebb and flow. Are they cleaning it? Are the nurses happy? Are the staff grumbling? Are nurses carrying food back up into the nurse's station, which they're not supposed to do necessarily? Once you know what to look for, it's almost, an amazing adventure to go into a hospital and see how good they are.
Have you found any hospitals with good food in the cafeteria?
I don't think I have found one hospital cafeteria where I'd say I'd go back again.
Okay. Thank you very much for talking with us about
your
series.
Sure. No, my pleasure.
Michael Barron's investigative series on hospital-acquired infections was published earlier this month in the Chicago Tribune. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of The Medicine Wheel Garden, Creating Sacred Space for Healing, Celebration, and Tranquility by E. Barry Kavash. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, how the nursing shortage is affecting hospital health care, we talk with two veteran registered nurses, and book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Prague, the debut novel by Arthur Phillips. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It isn't just common wisdom that good hospital nursing care increases the odds of a good recovery. A recent study published in the New England Journal of Medicine found that in hospitals with proportionately low numbers of registered nurses, patients are more likely to have urinary tract infections, hospital-acquired pneumonia, and gastrointestinal bleeding. These findings come at a time when many hospitals have cut back their nursing staffs to save money, while other hospitals are having trouble filling nursing positions. Another recent study, published in the health policy journal Health Affairs, showed many hospital nurses are burned out by staff shortages and rising patient loads. My guests are two veteran registered nurses. Kim Armstrong is a staff nurse at a high-risk obstetrics unit in a hospital in the Seattle-Tacoma area. Audrey Ludmer works in the perioperative care center of a major Manhattan hospital in a unit that performs endoscopies and colonoscopies. Both Armstrong and Ludmer work in hospitals that have fewer nurses than they used to. I asked Audrey Ludmer how that affects the amount of time she can spend with each patient.
I'm lucky in the area I've chosen to work, and I think part of the reason I chose to work there is that I get to work with one patient at a time. Because of the nature of my work, I can only be with one patient. But I'm under constant pressure to, you know, do an assembly line kind of thing, to get them in and get them out, and can't you do another case, can't you do another case, can't you do another case? So yes, it affects, and even though it's a short-term thing, you would like to do some teaching, a little pre-op relief of anxiety, a little pre-op teaching, and something about what's going to happen afterwards. But at times, you rush it. You don't not do it, you just don't do it as well. And you pray to God when you ask, do you have any questions, that the answer is no, because you may or may not have the moment to answer those questions. And I feel bad for a patient who's frightened because they need those extra few minutes, and sometimes you're really under pressure to not give it to them.
Kim Armstrong, how is your day-to-day work affected by the fewer number of registered nurses at your hospital now?
Well, I agree with Audrey. I'm lucky in the area that I work in that I'm primarily, when a patient's in active labor, I'm one-to-one care. However, it has still affected me even in that one-to-one care because we've decreased the amount of support systems we have. I pass dietary trays. I do phlebotomy. I do respiratory therapy treatments, various other things. I go from the moment that a patient enters my unit in labor through the recovery period, I take care of the baby after they're born. And all of it is done more or less as fast as we can do it. You know, we're moving at 100% when we get there and oftentimes have to flex up to 120%. And there's other patients coming in that are not in active labor that you still try to oversee. So the lack of backup systems has affected me even in my one-to-one care. When I'm having to clean up instruments and make beds and that kind of thing, that does affect the time that I could be spending elsewhere more profitably with the patient and teaching them about their health.
Now, Kim Armstrong, I understand the hospital where you work in the Tacoma, Seattle area is bringing in nurses from other countries. Why are they doing that?
Because they need nurses on the floor. My hospital does have posted positions for nurses, lots of them, in all sorts of specialty areas. They are bringing them in because they see it as a solution, even if it's a short-term solution, to their staffing needs. In the state of Washington last year, or this year actually, we passed a mandatory overtime law which prohibits employers and hospitals from forcing people to stay and work over their assigned hours. And you know, that's a very good first step in preventing what I call is abuse of nurses. But this is one of their answers to it. If they can't get people to stay over voluntarily, they still have patients that they need to care for. So they have recruited from the Philippines.
And how do you feel about that?
I think it's one of the most unethical ways to do any kind of business that there is.
Why is it unethical?
You have a country, oftentimes a third world country, that America, because they have the bucks, can go over and recruit these nurses away from their country. it severely impacts that country's ability to provide health care to their own people. So even in countries like the Philippines that actually graduate more nurses than they need, these nurses are not the new graduates that are coming. They are the experienced nurses from that country coming here. Once these nurses get here, it's almost like they're indentured servants.
Audrey Ludmer, do you have a similar situation in the hospital in New York where you were?
This is not a new problem in the hospitals in New York City. We used to have H-1 visa nurses coming in, and it was very similar to what Kim just talked about, in that the hospital sponsored them and the country allowed them in H-1 visas. The H-1 visas went away a number of years ago when it was prophesied that there would be too many nurses. And there was a Pew study that came out, and we were going to be extremely overstaffed and way too many nurses. So H-1 visa nurses seemed to go away. Schools of nursing closed. People went and found other professions. Hospitals started laying off nurses. It was very interesting to live through it. Very strange, but very interesting. As the population got sicker, the nurses became fewer. So it's not a new phenomena. It's not just the Philippines, but Korea, India, England, Ireland. The biggest problem is the cultural problem. The nurses from other countries and other countries themselves just have different cultural norms. And at times it becomes frustrating for both the nurse and for the patient in trying to communicate.
In addition to the language barrier, give me an example of the kind of cultural difference that you're talking about.
Just of what is acceptable as far as communication, what is acceptable as far as education, how you're treated as a patient, what is expected of you as a nurse. Many of the foreign nurses are not quite as assertive as American nurses are. So when you're trying to deal with a medical establishment and sometimes you're trying to get your point across, something is lacking in the fact of a nurse knowing that the doctor is, quote-unquote, her superior.
To me, when you're a patient and you're trying to impress upon the nurse, something's going wrong, I need help, they might not get it.
They may get it, but if the physician is not catching on quickly, they may let it go.
They may just defer and not push for
exactly.
It.
Right. Exactly.
And that's a huge problem because I don't know about other states, but in my state, my license is based on what I do for the patient. I am not responsible to my hospital, to the physicians, to anybody else. I am directly responsible by law to the patient for the quality of care they receive. I take that very seriously. These nurses coming in from other areas are not usually as assertive. I work with foreign nurses now, and even after years of being in the United States, they have a tendency to defer to the physician. And in some areas, you can't do that. And it's very frightening for these nurses, in my mind, that once they're here, if things don't work out for them, they're going to feel trapped.
Because in order to stay in the States, they have to keep the contract with the hospital?
That's correct.
So they don't want to rock the boat?
No.
Do you think the foreign nurses are being hired at your hospital because nurses aren't applying for the positions, or are the foreign nurses paid cheaper wages? Is there a kind of financial issue there, too?
Yeah, they will not be paid a cheaper rate than what the nurses here, because we're under contract. My hospital does have a union. So they will come in under our contract. But I think that the hospitals see them as available, and certainly the wages that they're going to be making in America are considerably more than the wages that they'd be making in their home country. So it's a very big incentive for them to come here.
I just wanted to add that the fact that they make the same amount as the nurses in the hospital, the same thing where I am, but they actually keep the wages down, because instead of increasing wages so more people will go into the profession, they artificially keep the wages down by pillaging other countries and artificially keep the salaries low.
My guests are two veteran registered nurses, Audrey Ludmer and Kim Armstrong. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking with two veteran registered nurses about the impact of nursing cutbacks and the nursing shortage. Kim Armstrong works in a hospital in the Seattle-Tacoma area. Audrey Ludmer works in a hospital in Manhattan. Audrey Ludmer, you've been a nurse since 1968. What are some of the biggest changes you see in the nursing profession from 1968 to now in terms of what's expected of you, how much support you have?
The biggest change has been in the amount of paperwork, the amount of documentation necessary. I spend a lot of time doing paper. At times, I spend more time with the paper than I do with the patient, which is a bizarre and ridiculous thing when you think about it. But in order to satisfy JCO, Medicaid, Medicare, HMOs, all the other insurance companies, there's tons of paperwork. And when I'm not doing paperwork, I'm sitting at a computer doing different kinds of work and different kinds of documentation on the computer. The computer is not at the patient's bedside. It's not anywhere near the patient. So therefore, the more time I spend on a computer, the less time I obviously spend with the patient. The other thing I wanted to say is that nursing has become increasingly complex. I'm expected to have a running knowledge, the basis of which wasn't even there in 1968.
Like what?
Disease entities, antibiotics. I remember when you had to know all the drugs. You know, now it's like a joke. Nobody knows all the drugs. It's just new medications on the market, new diseases, new pieces of instruments, new tests, new thoughts, new ideas, constant new re-education, new education, new products, new services. Patients are much, much, much more educated in what's going on and ask many more questions. It behooves you to know all the answers. Just the amount of physicians and what they're requiring and how they're requiring it and their turnover. Just your knowledge base is amazing. It's astounding.
Kim Armstrong, what are some of the biggest differences you've seen, some of the biggest changes you've seen from when you started in nursing to now?
Well, certainly patients are much, much, much sicker than they were
10 years ago. How so?
I always use this analogy that the patients that are in the hospital right now on a med-surg floor would have been in the PCUs and ICUs 10 years ago. The ones that are on the floor now are much sicker. You have a much heavier load, much more complicated disease processes than what they were 10 years ago. Those patients that were in the hospital 10 years ago are being cared for at home now through home health services, if they're lucky. Many times they're being cared for by loved ones. The patients that are in the ICUs now, I'm afraid 10 years, 15 years ago, wouldn't have survived to be in the ICUs simply because of our technology has increased so tremendously in the last 10 years that these patients were keeping patients alive that weren't alive 10 years ago.
So what practically does that mean for you as a nurse?
The knowledge base that you have to have of the new technologies, of the new drugs. Audrey mentioned the drugs. I think that there are now an average of 100 new drugs that come on the market each week. There is no way that we can keep up with that kind of knowledge. So we get a new drug on the board and it's like you have to know what you're giving and you have to stop and you have to look at what it is and the effects of it and the effects of it and all the other drugs that the patient's taken at the time. And that without a lot of backup systems that we used to have with pharmacy help and stuff like that. I'm very concerned that the nurses are the in line because we're the ones that administer the drugs. we have started to become responsible, held responsible, and sometimes criminally responsible for those drugs. Nurses don't have, when they have hundreds of drugs sometimes to give in one shift, don't have the time to also be the backup system, but yet we have to be.
Do either of you have an example of a time when you feel you averted catastrophe by observing a mistake that was about to happen?
Yeah.
You want to tell the story?
We, in labor and delivery, give a drug called Pitocin. It's to make the uterus contract. It's in a mixture of 10 milliunits within 500 cc's. And a bag came, and it's mixed by pharmacy. A bag came up that was marked 100 milliunits per 500 cc's, or 100 units per 500 cc's. And when I caught it and called the pharmacy, yeah, that was what was in it. But if I had hung that on a patient inadvertently by not seeing where the decimal point was, we could have really easily killed a baby and a mother.
The other thing I wanted to bring up, and it may not be so much in Kim, but in my area, where you have multiple physicians, and physician A writes one regimen, physician B writes a second, physician C writes a third, they make no sense together, and they don't talk to each other, and because they're each treating a different part of the person's body, as opposed to treating the patient, and it's the nurse that puts the pieces together and says, this is the patient. Let me get you all in a room and talk to each other, or, you know, tries to run interference between the different parties to make sure that the patient is cared for properly.
Is this a bigger problem than it used to be because there are so many different areas of specialization now, and a patient in a hospital is likely to be seeing three or four different specialists?
Well, there's that they're seeing so many people, but it's also the fact that the length of stay has decreased dramatically, so that everybody's trying to do something very quickly.
I understand that you have both been patients in your own hospitals. Audrey Ledmer, from your point of view as a patient, what did you experience? What did you see right or wrong with the medical staff?
Unfortunately, I've been a patient multiple times, and I can see the changes. The last few times I was in a hospital, I made sure one of my friends stayed with me overnight. One of my friends who was a nurse stayed with me overnight. Each time I had surgery and was extremely out of it for the first few hours after the surgery, and I wanted to make sure there was somebody competent there to watch what was happening to me. And again, not because the nurses are bad and not because the nurses are cruel, but because they're just so overwhelmingly busy that I wanted to make sure that I got the care that I thought I should be getting. And having been a visitor in a hospital, I can tell you that that's not always the case, that nurses run in and run out because they're really running. They literally are running. They're on a treadmill running.
Kim Armstrong, what about you?
Well, I saw very caring nurses who wanted to do an excellent job, who didn't have the time to do it, that were working double shifts, that didn't have time and made assumptions that because I was a nurse, I could figure it out myself. And I think since it wasn't my area of expertise, I didn't have a clue. I saw things omitted that I knew had been ordered for me because I was very much my advocate and had it spelled out prior to coming in. And it was because of lack of time. It was because I was a lower priority patient on that floor because I was basically healthy with a minor problem that needed overnight hospitalization, that they were more concerned with their higher level of acuity patients, their sicker patients, that those patients needed them more than I did. I, too, had somebody stay with me overnight. And if I could say anything to consumers out there is be aware of what's going on with yourself and what's going on within hospitals and advocate for yourself and ask questions. And make somebody, no matter how short a time they are, answer those questions for you to your satisfaction.
Audrey Ledmer, any consumer advice you'd add?
I just want to say something about nursing, because it sounds like we've been saying all the negative things, but there are a lot of extremely positive things. Nursing can be extremely rewarding. You can certainly make the difference in a person's life. Nurses are working as hard as they can, against great odds at times, to provide the best care that they possibly can.
I'd like to say one more thing. I agree with Audrey with what she said about nurses. We do a great job telling the world what's wrong with our profession, but not what's right with it. And I don't know of another profession that you can touch someone's life as effectively as you can in nursing. I wouldn't trade it for anything. If I was to do it over, I might make different choices, but I'd still be a nurse somehow, some way. People need to hear that it is a rewarding profession and it's challenging every day.
Well, thank you both so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Kim Armstrong works in a hospital in the Seattle-Tacoma area. Audrey Ludmer works in a hospital in Manhattan. They're both registered nurses. Coming up, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the new novel, Prague. This is Fresh Air. Another week, another fine first novel is published. At least that's the way this year has felt so far to our book critic, Maureen Corrigan. Here's her review of Arthur Phillips' new novel, Prague.
Halfway through 2002, the verdict is already in. This is the year of the great first novel. The Lovely Bones by Alice Sebold, Everything is Illuminated by Jonathan Safran Foer, The Dive from Clawson's Pier by Ann Packer, they're all stunners, written by folks young enough to be Philip Roth's great-grandchildren. In such an exceptional literary season, critics like me get awfully picky. Judging any new novel, I feel like the legendary Dick Button issuing verdicts on Olympic figure skaters. A clumsy gesture here and there, too much obvious sweat gleaming off the page, or a wobbly finish demotes a hopeful contestant from the gold to the shadowy realm of the silver or bronze. That's where Arthur Phillips' new, much-heralded first novel, Prague, lands in my estimation. In an ordinary year, Phillips might have gotten his face on a Wheaties box, but the competition right now is as cutthroat as Tonya Harding with an iron bar and a willing accomplice nearby. Prague tracks the fortunes of five young American expatriates who travel to Budapest in the early 1990s to find adventure, money, love, and themselves. Hold on, you geography experts might be saying. Why is the book called Prague when it takes place in Hungary? The answer is that this novel is an exquisite specimen of the irony age. Almost every character here is self-mocking, self-divided, and conscious of living a lesser life filled with substitutes, whether they be lovers or careers or cities. Prague, which is a more beautiful and booming city than Budapest, is a metaphor of dreams deferred, like Moscow is for Chekhov's Three Sisters. It's where the characters would rather be. For instance, in an emblematic conversation, one ambitious young woman excitedly tells a friend about a guy from home who's living in Prague now. He's trying to start a business making frozen desserts shaped like Proust and Freud, and they're called Findesicles. Almost every page of this novel is filled with clever riffs like that one. Indeed, the opening scene, in which the characters play a nasty game called Sincerity, introduces Prague's signature tone of brittle humor. Seated around the cafe table on a late afternoon are the five principals: Charles Gabor, a would-be entrepreneur; Emily Oliver, a diplomatic flunky whose Midwestern niceness is either a vestigial trait left over from a vanished America or a brilliant espionage cover; and Mark Payton, a graduate student working on a dissertation about the history of nostalgia, appropriate since he longs for any time other than his own. Also playing are John Price, a fledgling journalist and the only employee at his newspaper not writing a screenplay during working hours, and his older brother Scott, a former English major who now teaches at an English language school, because like almost every other English major, he discovers his degree is only valuable proportionally to how far he wanders from home. What happens to these lost generation Xers is far less interesting than how Phillips describes it happening. And there you have the strength and the weakness of Prague the novel. Stylistically, Prague is a delight. Entertaining and often insightful comments on relationships, cuisine, architecture, sexuality, and the fall of communism abound. But the narrative exhausts itself about halfway through. Phillips establishes his dramatic situations and then lets them slump. It almost feels as though storytelling itself is too earnest an endeavor for this relentlessly ironic novel. A novel, after all, that's even distanced from its own title. Maybe, in the end, the most intriguing thing about Prague and the other first novels I mentioned earlier is that they're bold in scope, spreading out over time and space. Nearly 20 years ago, Tom Wolfe wrote a famous essay for The Atlantic Monthly in which he contrasted his then-new Dickensian novel, The Bonfire of the Vanities, to the constricted and introspective fiction that had dominated post-World War II American literature. This new young crop of American fiction writers seems to be infected with Wolfe's ambition, sidestepping small stories and instead attempting sweeping tales of grand cities and great expectations.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Prague by Arthur Phillips. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, the TV and movie industries from the point of view of the writers. We feature excerpts of the recent Writers Guild Foundation conference. Speakers include writers David Milch of NYPD Blue, Aaron Sorkin of The West Wing, and Stephen Gagan of Traffic. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air. NPR, is that the only fix?